Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. 11 March 2011, the day the Earth stopped. A tsunami leading to a catastrophe that we now think of as Fukushima, Japan. This was a nuclear accident at the end of a sea tsunami sweeping in from the Pacific. Someone who was in Tokyo at the time and later became the rescue and repair part of the operation, Grant Newsham joins. Colonel, United States Marine Corps, retired. And as I understand, Grant published this piece 7 years after. It's now 14 years after. And the details are a fascination to me because I was just finishing my broadcast in New York about the time that the news came in that there was a tsunami sweeping into Japan. And there was at least one helicopter, maybe more. Live shots or shots that looked live. This is before we had high-end communication systems, so you couldn't be sure, on the television. And the picture of a tsunami that looked about an inch high from the distance the helicopter was shooting, sweeping in and rushing over buildings and crashing through cars. The few people we could tell who had retreated to a higher place watched the water rush underneath them. It was a fascination. What we didn't think through at that point, because there was no reason to, I didn't know the geography, is that the Fukushima nuclear power plant, actually was called Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, was in the target zone of the tsunami. Grant, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. You were in Tokyo when the original earthquake hit Tohoku in 2011. Were your thoughts of tsunami, was Tokyo shots of thoughts of tsunami at that time, or was it a surprise? Good evening to you.
Oh, good evening, John. I was in Tokyo, and we had the biggest earthquake I'd ever felt, ever before or since. And you usually sort of just ride these out, and you know they're going to end. This one didn't. It kept going. Huge, huge shock. And I was on, the 16th floor of a 35-story building. So this was like something I'd never experienced. And then it happened, and everyone goes outside and evacuates, and you catch your breath, and then that's that. But there'd been, and you hear words that something had happened up north in Tohoku, which is northeast Japan, and you didn't realize that just how bad it was, because tsunamis and earthquakes, part of the deal in Japan. But this was something nobody had ever experienced. And then very quickly, the information flowed in that just how bad it was. And the tsunami, of course, comes afterwards. And so it was, probably within about maybe 35 to minutes to an hour and a half that it hit northeast Japan, and that's when all the destruction and all the death started.
But the beginning of the tragedy right then, because the next day, retired Marine colonels have phone numbers and the Marines have them, okay? So whatever, you get a call from the Marine Corps, and of course you say yes immediately, and you spent several days in the mounting of the rescue effort and the recovery effort in Tokyo, and you were watching what we're watching about the Fukushima reactors. Was there alarm in Tokyo? Because I remember reporting over the next few days that there was a possibility of a radioactive cloud heading south to Tokyo. Was that reported in Tokyo at the time?
It was. It took a little while for the nuclear threat to fully materialize. I was actually a reservist, so they called and asked if I would like to be useful, so I said yes. And had a very good assistant who took over at my civilian job. But the nuclear issue came up within a few days. I think it took a little while. And I remember being at Yokota Air Base when getting briefed about this at the main U.S. headquarters. And one of the staff came in and said, "Oh, Fukushima just blew up." I'm thinking, oh, boy, you know, I'd rather be in Philly. But you act like nothing new. And at that point, there was a lot of problems that were happening. And the news of the nuclear disaster, the nuclear threat, actually didn't come out immediately. The government actually tried to hush it up. And there was a lot of rumors and speculation going on. And then within a matter of days, the threat of the fear of a nuclear cloud, the swarm or whatever they called it, that was ever present. And that's when people started to really panic. But they say that took a few days. So you had this huge, you know, had the tsunami and earthquake damage up in the Northeast, and that was bad enough. And then you throw in this nuclear plant that's melting down or blowing up, whatever you call it. And that just made things much more complicated.
What happens next is that Grant is asked to volunteer to go to the zone and help with recovery of an airport. And how did you get there, Grant?
Well, for the first time in my life, somebody flew a private airplane to take me somewhere. I think the Marines brought a plane down to Yokota and took me up to Sendai. It actually landed at the airport, and that's the central airport in northeast Japan. And it was able to land. It was a C-12, so a smallish plane. But also it was because the Marines had actually gotten up there very quickly, within like 48, 72 hours, flying CH-46s from Okinawa. And that's a very short-legged helicopter. But they got there, and the Japanese thought that the airport was done. And the Marine engineers looked at it and said, "Oh, it would probably give us a few days." And they got it usable in a fairly short time. And there was also, interestingly, it doesn't get any attention, there was a Marine task force from a place called Camp Fuji, which is a little Marine base west of Tokyo. And the commander there, Craig Kozinski, Colonel Craig Kozinski, on his own initiative said, "Well, I've got all these people, we've got equipment, let's go north." And that is not how things are done in Japan. But he got them rolling, and they, with some help from a Marine general at U.S. Forces Japan, they broke through a lot of bureaucratic obstacles, and they got up there, and they were actually the manpower behind all of this effort. It's these, you know, Marines from Camp Fuji, and they don't get the attention. And there was also a fellow named Dr. Robert Eldridge, who was the political advisor for the Marines from Okinawa. He went up there and he knew everybody practically in Japan. And he actually got somebody to produce two forklifts from somewhere. And the Air Force, this was key to everything. And there was a small Air Force detachment that handles these sorts of situations. I wasn't sure they were actually Americans because they had such long hair and I didn't recognize the new uniforms. But these guys went in and they got the airport functioning in very little time, which surprised everyone. But this is all taking place in the context of a huge Japanese effort. And the Americans really played a supporting role. They did everything they could to be useful once they realized that that's all they could do. But it was the Japanese side that did 99.99% of the work. Most of that was done by the Japanese military. And most of that was by the Japanese army.
I want to press you on this point because this is a crisis. It's not war fighting, but it might as well be because you have the challenge of how do you work with militaries that may or may not be sympathetic to procedures that are similar or not similar in their understanding of their jobs. The Japanese Self-Defense Force, the Marine Self-Defense Force, the Ground Self-Defense Force have restrictions on how they can work with America or vice versa in some fashion. What are those?
Oh, goodness. They were really very tight procedural, bureaucratic, legal restrictions that made it very hard for the Americans and the Japanese side to actually get together. People didn't even know what they were allowed to do in the event of a contingency. It was that bad. There were lawyers actually at the main Japanese headquarters in Tokyo where I was, and theoretically lawyers from Ministry of Defense, and supposedly they were going to approve everything that got done. We ignored them, and as a practical matter, things happened. And you saw the two navies, the U.S. Navy and the Japanese Navy, were actually they just fell right in. And the U.S. Navy gave what help they could. They didn't actually go out, but they supported the Japanese going up there. And it was the first time, I think, that both sides had ever had to really respond to anything. And the Japanese were, as they'd shown in the Kobe earthquake in 1995 or so, they were reluctant to accept assistance. Well, but this time they were less reluctant. And the Americans were there offering. And the Japanese were saying, yeah, we made it work, but it should not have been the case, given how long supposedly there was this excellent relationship between the forces. Really was in that respect, I always thought, a huge embarrassment that neither side really knew how to respond to a real world contingency. The Japanese, they did, but to work together, that was a first time. And it should not have been the case. I would note there was also like something like 18 American generals from different services who showed up in Japan wanting a piece of the action. I think that was probably 17 too many. But it was a new thing for everybody.
There are lessons learned when we come back. I'm speaking to Grant Newsham, Colonel Grant Newsham, United States Marine Corps retired, author of When China Attacks. A crisis needs volunteers, and they exist, but how do they work together? What do they learn about how they handle the crisis? This is CBS Eye on the World, 14 years after the Fukushima tragedy.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.